This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The Goat's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Good day once again, you beautiful vinyl nerds. You welcome to episode 13 of Liner Note Leftovers. And when we started this podcast, I said I had a goal in mind to get more episodes in than the Geico Caveman television show, because that's the key to success. If we can do better than them, we're doing all right. And we have done better. We're at 13 episodes now, but my weird beef with terrible network TV notwithstanding, you want to talk about the vinyl nerdery. You want to go crate digging. You want to hear some wild out stories from the history of rock and roll, and I've got quite a few for you. I got a story about meeting your heroes by lying and getting on a VIP list, and also you're covered in Axl and tire grease. A supergroup formed out of that, though, so there's something to it. Things that you can do with your hands, unless Gene Simmons tells you you can't. Don't worry, it didn't go anywhere, because turns out ripping off Wiccans, ancient Buddhists, and Mesopotamians, and don't forget Ronnie James Dio, doesn't get you anywhere. And also, we're getting into the ghost stories just a little bit, and the weird, freaky occurrences around Sympathy for the Devil. All that and more coming up on tonight's Liner Note Leftovers. Let's drop that needle, music nerds, and get on into it. You never really know how a friendship is gonna get started. It doesn't usually start by sneaking your name on Bob Dylan's shout-out list, but in this context, it did. So it was on June 7th, 1978, or 77, the details are a little hazy, that Bob Dylan's playing a show at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles. And Tom Petty is a huge, huge fan of Bob Dylan. He had been since he first heard Like a Rolling Stone back in the mid-60s. But this show is a hot ticket. Everybody who's everybody is going to be at this show. But luckily, the promoter, Danny Bramson, is a low-key champion of Tom Petty, who's just starting to find his footing with the Heartbreakers after Mudcrutch totally dissolves. And Petty's doing all right. He's got a couple of songs in the chart, but he's not really there yet. So sneaky, sneaky, Bramson puts Tom Petty's name on the list of Bob Dylan's shoutouts, which also had Raquel Welch on it, Joni Mitchell, that kind of thing. Dylan doesn't even know who Tom Petty is, and it's not really that usual for him to shout out celebrities anyways. But still, he does it, and in the meantime, while he's getting ready, Tom Petty and his legendary roadie Bugs Wendell are on their way to the amphitheater, and poof, their tire goes flat. So they gotta get out, change the thing, they get coated in grease and dirt, because cars are whipping by them on this LA highway. They manage to get there just after the beginning of the show, and they sit there, they jam along, they're starstruck, that kind of thing. But then Bob starts going, and Joni Mitchell's here, and Raquel Welch is here, and Tom Petty's here. He's an up-and-coming rising star. This blows Tom Petty's mind. Like, his hero just shouted him out, man. Or one of his heroes just shouted him out. Bob invites them backstage, says that's pretty crafty. They have a short conversation, and they keep in touch. The Heartbreakers are his backing band at Farm Aid, because Bob just didn't want to play acoustic at that time in his career. So he hired up the Heartbreakers as the electrical band. Tom Petty produces tracks for Bob Dylan. And from Tom Petty talking about it in the book Chronicles, there was a lot of learning done at the foot of the master. And I say that a little bit facetiously, because Bob Dylan was only about 10 years older than Tom Petty. But Tom says he learned things like improvisation, taking roots from Bob Dylan's inspirations of jazz masters. They would throw obscure rock and roll songs at each other, and they would play them and learn from each other. They helped write each other write materials. But by the time Tom Petty was established in his own right, Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne all form the Traveling Wilburys. And now, that love, that relationship, that's laid down on a track forever. Several tracks, in fact. And sometimes as a rock star, that's all you can ask for. Especially when your first meeting has you covered in tire and road grease and still getting snuck in on the VIP list. Shoot your shot, I guess.
You can sit around and wait for the phone to ring. Waiting for someone to tell you everything. Sit around and wonder what tomorrow will bring. Maybe a diamond ring. Well, it's all.
Survivor's Eye of the Tiger EP album dropped June 8th, 1982. And we could focus on the whole album, but we really want to talk about what's the most notable, and that is Survivor's Eye of the Tiger, which was the catalyst for the album and a major catalyst for their career, and also not even supposed to happen. So here's the thing. When Stallone was making Rocky III, he initially thought of a different song for the training montage. It was supposed to be Queen's Another One Bites the Dust, but for some reason, just couldn't get the publishing rights, even though it worked really well in the scene, according to everybody involved. But Sly Stallone says, all right, how do we follow up with this and make it as good? Depending on who you ask, either his friend, Scotty Brothers label boss Tony Scotty, reached out to Survivor to ask to see if it would happen, or according to Survivor singer Jim Peterik, Sly Stallone called them himself because for some reason they had a voicemail machine, which was a luxury in 1982, and literally left the message,
yo, Jim, this is Sly Stallone. Give me a call. We need to talk.
Either way, what is known is that Sly had been a huge fan of Poor Man's Son, which was the band's first chart hit, and somebody played Cupid in this scenario. So as was the style at the time with a lot of 80s movies, they shoot the footage first, and then they give that footage to Survivor, and they're literally trying to write a song as they jam along watching the fight scene in the movie. Writing chords, coming up with lyrics, kind of as they go. So finally, they piece something together, and they give it to Sly, and they say, if you don't like it, we'll go back in the studio, we'll professionally re-record it now that we have an idea. Sly loved it. Literally just dubbed it into the film right away, and Survivor went back to the studio, re-recorded a version for the album, so the one you hear on the album is not the same from Rocky 3, but it's all the same vibes anyways. And interestingly enough, Frankie Sullivan, the guitarist for Survivor, was the only one in possession of a copy of Rocky 3 with the original Queen's Another One Bites the Dust dubbed over the fight scene. He owns a copy, Sly Stallone owns a copy, and Brian May from Queen owns a copy because Queen asked Frankie to send him a copy because he didn't have it either. So it really makes you think, if all that record label stuff wasn't involved, what would Rocky 3 look like? What would Survivor's career look like? And would we have had the biggest song of 1982? Seriously, that's what it is if you look at the data. And also, would we have the 47,000 parodies that have been done of it since? Something to think about, maybe. It's not like a Queen song's ever been parodied. Yes, right. A long, long time ago, I used to live in a town called Parry Sound, Ontario. There was a big controversy for a couple of years because some guy who owned a company tried to trademark the term Welcome to Parry Sound. It ended in a riot. He was run out of town. I'm pretty sure his family still doesn't live there. So, the lesson? Don't try to trademark things you don't own. But that was not the case in the life of Gene Simmons, who on June 9th, 2017 put a trademark claim in that he had invented the rock and roll devil horns. And any rock and roll fan knows what I'm talking about. Throw them up at a concert, throw them up at your friends, throw them up in traffic. But Gene Simmons claimed he invented it in 1974 on the Hotter Than Hell Kiss tour. And a lot of people were quick to point out that, no, you absolutely did not. In fact, it's been around for thousands of years. In Indian classical dance, it symbolizes the lion. In Buddhism, it's a gesture to expel demons. In Mediterranean culture, with the fingers tilting downwards, it wards off bad luck. In Wicca, then it invokes or represents the horned god. And in fact, it's widely believed that the first time it was used in a rock and roll context was the Chicago-based psychedelic band Coven, who is seen on their album Witchcraft Destroys Minds and Reaps Souls as giving the signs of the horns. John Lennon also did it earlier in 1969 with the thumb out, which, as you know, is the ASL sign for I Love You. It can also be seen and known as the P-Funk sign when it comes to Parliament Funkadelic. And of course, Ronnie James Dio, who is widely said to have popularized using it in heavy metal. So, of course, every musician is saying, dude, where do you get off, Gene Simmons? This is not your symbol. In fact, Ronnie James Dio's widow was the one who was the most pissed off, saying this was never yours to trademark anyways. It wasn't Dio's either. It's everybody's. And Gene Simmons' response to this was literally, I can do what I want. which let's just say did not help the situation in the slightest. Eventually, the backlash got too great. Gene Simmons gave it up, but when asked if it was the silliest thing he'd ever done, he said no. The silliest thing he ever did is wear more makeup and higher heels than your mom.
God, what a...
But what was it? Was it a publicity stunt? Was it a vanity exercise? Was it a little bit of both or something else? I don't know. But I'll just say this. Throw up a pair of devil horns today whenever you see somebody and know that you're pissing Gene Simmons off. In fact, we're going to do it right now because he's not going to get any royalty money. And we're going to listen to a good dude who popularized the devil horns. This is Ronnie James Dio. Nah, take that. Just a heads up, we're gonna have some spoilers for The Sopranos here. You had 14 years to watch the show, so either bail now or speak now or forever hold your peace. But everybody remembers where they were when that ending happened. Those strains of don't stop believing, don't stop, and then it cuts to black. And in that 5 seconds of black before credits rolled, complete pandemonium happens. There's people checking their cable boxes. There's people already writing angry letters to HBO. I still remember being 11 years old, sleeping in my bed, and hearing my old man from the living room, "Oh, come on!" And we had a new TV after that. I'm not sure if he threw it out the window, but whatever. Basically, that song, perfect for the ending, though. The cutoff, magnificent. But it almost didn't happen for two reasons. First off, when writing that final episode, showrunner David Chase had 3 songs in mind. He can't remember the first, but the other was Al Green's Love and Happiness, and the third one was Don't Stop Believin'. And he went with Don't Stop Believin' because the rest of the Sopranos writing crew told him, no, absolutely not. It's a corny 80s tune, you will ruin your show doing this. And Steve Perry of Journey didn't want to give him the rights to Don't Stop Believin' anyways, because he thought it was going to be used in a gory, blast-em-up shootout, and that's not how he wanted the song to be used. So, sworn to secrecy, David Chase gives Steve Perry the ending of The Sopranos, and apparently it was super hard to keep a lid on it. Like, the other bandmates couldn't even know. That's how crazy it was. But the combination of that song hitting at the end of The Sopranos and the start of the iTunes days, which was also in 2007, meant that millions of people started listening to Journey again. In fact, so many people listened to it, it made it a number one hit song 37 years after it was released. And Don't Stop Believin' was kind of a flop when it was originally released. So what's with the lasting impact? Well, according to legendary Hollywood music supervisor Gary Calamar, he compared it with songs like Night Ranger's Sister Christian being used in Boogie Nights, or Steeler's Wheel in Reservoir Dogs. It's one of those things that really gets under your skin and sticks with you. It juxtaposes it, it gives you a sense of impending danger. And he also explained the reason why you hear Don't Stop Believin' in just about every TV show now. It's not just because The Sopranos did it. He says it's batting practice for a music supervisor. You play Don't Stop Believin', whether it's in Family Guy, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, or at a hockey game, you're almost always gonna hit it out of the park with a big old power ballad and a big over-the-top scene. And think about it, he's kinda right, because if you really picture this scene here, the ending of The Sopranos, could you picture it any other way, working with any other song? You get this rising crescendo of action, there's about to be something dangerous, you can feel it happen, the climax is coming, and then... I know, we talk about the Stones a whole lot, but there's some things I can't pass up, because not only am I a big guy for music knowledge, but I'm a big guy for something of a paranormal story, perhaps. Just hear me out on this one. The details are a little fudgy. Depending on who you ask, it was either on June 11th, 1968, or June 10th, 1968, that the Rolling Stones finished recording Sympathy for the Devil, which, crazy enough, has a whole bunch of freaky occurrences associated with it. Based on the the book The Man and the Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, Mick Jagger has said, despite the devilish imagery, it's based on the dark side of man. It's not a celebration of anything else, even though they used it in promotional material at the time. But here's where it starts getting freaky. While they're writing the song, that line, "Who killed the Kennedys," was part of it, but it was originally just, "Who killed Kennedy?" Bobby Kennedy wasn't dead yet. He died while the song was being written. Okay, a little weird, but let's move on. While they're recording the song, and the documentary crew recording the Gimme Shelter documentary is filming that, a lamp explodes and catches fire. Now, nobody got hurt here, but a bunch of their recording material got all cooked up. I know, it's getting a little weirder, isn't it? But either way, the Stones record it, lay it down, and ends up on the Beggar's Banquet album. But here's where things get really weird. You've probably heard of the Altamont Speedway concert for the Rolling Stones. It was a disastrous concert that saw a fan get murdered by the bikers the Rolling Stones had hired as security. It was a horrible thing. But what's really freaky about it is Carlos Santana. Did you know he was the opening act at that gig? You didn't. Because he demanded that all of his performances be stripped from the documentary and never brought to air. Why, you might be asking? Well, Carlos Santana said to the Stones before they played it, "Guys, you best not. The devil's not Santa Claus, he's for real." And they're like, "Yeah, all right, whatever." But Santana says he could feel something weird in the air, a presence, if you will. And two songs later, during Under My Thumb, what happened at Altamont happened at Altamont. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes into this legend here. When the Stones did Rock and Roll Circus, they played this song, and for some reason, that concert was so bad they never brought it to air. Also, Guns N' Roses attributes this song to their breakup as well, too. They covered it in 94 for the movie Interview with a Vampire. It was the first appearance of new guitarist Paul Huge, which caused considerable conflict in the band, and it was the last song Axl Rose Slash and Duff McKagan ever recorded together. It broke up GNR. Now, all of this you could say is conspiracy and speculation and just getting real deep into the paranormal, but I will say this. On the 89 Steel Wheels tour, the Stones performed this with Mick Jagger standing high in front of a fire, but you best believe that he was wearing a safety belt that time, just in case some Final Destination trip and fall thing type happened. So be cautious in case anything spooky happens here, but it's the song that started it all, Sympathy for the Devil.
I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his fate. Pleased to meet you, hope you guess my name.
And with that, that's the end of another Liner Note Leftovers. A slightly spooky note to end this week's episode. But don't worry, I was right here along with you the whole time. Nothing's gonna get you, and there'll be plenty of time to nerd out to vinyl and rock music history as we go. But on that note, I have to give a little bit of an announcement here, friends. I will be taking a little bit of a break from Liner Note Leftovers. Don't worry, it won't be very long. Next week, there won't be an episode. It's just something you need to do from time to time to keep those brain juices flowing, to rekindle that passion. You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And you know, I just need some time to veg out, to crate dig, and maybe hit up my old favorite record haunts for more stories to tell you. But just know that I love you very much. I appreciate that you've geeked out with me a little bit through these last 13 episodes. Well, 14 if you count the Saskadelphia bonus episode. And just know that I've appreciated you being a part of this for the longest time, and hopefully we can do it for a long time to continue. But I'm gonna leave you with a little bit of homework, and don't groan, it's something you're gonna enjoy. Dig into an album that you love, or maybe you've never even heard before. Really dig into the liner notes, listen to every single bit of musical score, let yourself fade on into those liner note leftovers. I'll see you in the next one, and as always, grab your vinyl and life by the edges. We'll see you again real soon, my lovelies.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.